Okay. All right. Thank you, Monica. It is Tuesday, September 23rd. My good friend Billy's birthday. 2025. Bill was the lead guitar player in my high school band. Taught me a lot. Let's see. We are here now. Whatever, wherever here is for you, and whatever now is. I see that the Reverend Freakchild is going under a new alias here. Anyway, folks, sorry. It's another Tuesday. Next Tuesday, I'm going to be in New Orleans. Is anybody coming? All right. Oh, yes, Karen, you're coming. I heard you were coming. Oh, Carolyn, great. Yeah, you're making that one. Good. All right. Yeah, I'm teaching a retreat in Mississippi for Flowering Lotus, but I'm going to fly into New Orleans day early so I can walk around on the streets and listen to street music. That's my goal. I am going to take my earplugs so that can go indoors and hear indoor music because I can't do that anymore without earplugs, sadly. We're recording this, aren't we? Wow. No, next Tuesday is not canceled. I will be broadcasting from my hotel room, presumably.
But I will be
Oh,
not
yeah, that's
here.
right. Monica won't be here, so it will not be recorded for posterity or for your post. No, wait a minute. Don't make stupid jokes. We're going to meditate, at least ostensibly, for 20 minutes. And then I don't have, I've been writing so furiously that I guess I'm going to have to talk about what I'm writing because I don't have anything else to talk about. I've fallen into a habit of calling any people that I'm with kids. So I was just about to call this group. Say, okay, kids, but you're not really, or maybe it's all in the mind. You've been with a retreat with me when Greg always does this nice, Qigong thing where you're breathing out, letting the energy go down. Doing Qigong on Zoom. It's not that great. Sitting down, it's okay. And Greg reminds us that you don't even have to make the physical movements. You can actually visualize the movements and work with the breath. So, all right, settling into your posture, closing your eyes or lowering your gaze. And just first feeling what's going on for you right now, internally, physically, emotionally, energetically, mentally. Just kind of a check-in. How are you? And a reminder that your posture is directly related to your energetic state and your clarity. It's quite interesting, actually, to see how sometimes quite subtle shifts in posture can change how we feel. Talk about body language. That language is also internal, it speaks to us. And feeling the body breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. Having a sense of settling, softening. Now, this is the kind of first task of our meditation is to just calm down. Get more calm, more focus, more clarity. And this first task is sometimes the only one we work on during a period of meditation. And we may succeed or fail at this task, but the result is not the real purpose of it. If we are sitting and trying to meditate and we find that either the body won't cooperate, that it's too anxious or agitated, or the mind is too disturbed and busy, then we are seeing something. We are bringing mindfulness to our experience, knowing that's what's happening right now. And this is the heart of our practice, awareness. There are other elements. This is the one that is really key to practice. So when things are not going the way we'd like, how do we react to that? Can we accept that? Just experience the disturbance or agitation without rebelling, without pushing it away. And we may find that simply that attitude itself has a positive effect on the states. All states are impermanent, they're bound to change. So if we don't feed them, they will eventually fade away. The less we stir them up, fight with them, the less energy they have, the more quickly they tend to dissipate. Our minds are complicating machines. This practice is one of uncomplicating. Trying to find interest in the simplicity of breath. Discovering the beauty of a calm mind, peaceful body. I didn't give much meditation instruction. I hope for people that's okay. Not sure what direction I want to go in right now, but maybe I'll start by just, I mentioned before we started that I was doing some writing right up to before the class started, and I was drawing in something from one of my earlier books and from One Breath at a Time, my first book, and it was something I described having an insight back in, I think it was 1996, so almost 30 years ago. And what was a little disturbing was realizing, like, oh, I saw this. And it was about the section of One Breath at a Time called Feeling Feelings. And there's three sections, and the third one describes being on a retreat and kind of waking up every morning and with this kind of uncomfortable feeling that I was trying to identify, and I finally sort of identified it as fear. But then eventually sort of it's like, well, maybe it's just like a feeling, like an energy, like, you wake up and you have a feeling, and that idea that, we have feelings and we put names on them is really, it's an important idea in Buddhism. And it's, described, we can say that in the teaching on the five aggregates, or it's form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, the perception is the state at which we turn the feelings that are either in the body or the mind or both, that kind of precede the perception. Perception is when we put a name on things. And it's a critical moment in Buddhist teachings. Our ordinary way of viewing the world is that things are what they are. Feelings are things that, our therapist will say, well, what did that feel and feel like, and what, and sort of ask us to name our feelings, right? This is something, an ordinary way in Western psychology of approaching our mind, is like to give names to our experiences. And that has a value and a use in a certain context, but it also has the unfortunate effect, I won't call it a side effect because it's a direct effect, of making things more real for us, and in a sense limiting our understanding of what's happening to us. We put this interpretation, this perception, this naming, this labeling onto an experience that's just a feeling. And many of you have sat retreats with me, or been sitting with me enough to know that this is, something that I keep coming back to and mulling and talking about. When Yeah, and well, I'll get to the specifics of where this is coming from in terms of what I'm writing and my own experience, which is that, when I was 14 and I started to have this unpleasant feeling, I called it depression. And that naming and that labeling became an identity. And so that this unpleasant feeling became for me associated with who I was. And as we know, through Buddhist teachings on self, there was a clinging to that, even though it was painful. And there was this narrowing of my understanding of things. There was no other space to understand what was happening other than it's this thing that's this problem that I have. So It's in me. I own it. It is me. So the I, me, mine of identity became like who I was, and it was something that I had. And then in psychological terms or in medical terms, it was a pathology. There was something wrong with me, which means I shouldn't have it, which really sets up a problem in the mind. You have this thing that you shouldn't have. There's something wrong with you. And that then belief, which is another, a secondary perception, right? Then triggers more unpleasant feelings because it feels bad to think there's something wrong with me. And now you're creating this cycle, right? Which you're just caught in because it's this whole belief system of how things work, of who you are and what is happening. This is what is happening. And these are the implications of it. This is the meaning of it. And you have to deal with it. And I spent a year in a mental hospital at 18 to 19, not dealing with it because there was never any, the thing that was lacking was any awareness of the actual experience. As soon as there was a feeling, it was so quickly identified, perceived, named, that I went beyond what does it actually feel like? And so, I, as I was writing this morning and sort of thinking about this, I referred to one of the first things I learned in meditation, which was to be aware of sensations in my body and then aware of the pain in my knees that was very persistent when I used to be able to sit with my legs crossed. And what I was taught then was just actually examine the sensation, because just like emotional pain, physical pain, we so quickly move away from it and try to fix it that we never actually go like, well, what does that actually feel like? Which is natural. I mean, why would you want to sit there and feel pain? Well, there actually is a value to it. And in meditation, since we're trying to practice being aware of reality, then if reality is the sensation in the knee, then can I just be aware of it for a while? Do I have to run from it right away? No, I don't have to. I can actually just be with it. And then it turns out, when you get involved in this process, that it's quite interesting that your attention goes into this sensation in the knee, for example. And the first thing you see is that you can't quite find it because it's not a thing. It's not just a pain. We have this idea, pain is a thing that's there, it's right there, it's in my knee, I can feel. No, wait, when I actually go and try to look for it, because it's just my mind is going, oh, there's pain in my knee. Let's do something about it. No, when my attention just goes, well, okay, can I actually see? What's it look like? No, I can't find. Oh, it's moving, right? First thing we see, right? This impermanence in Nietzsche. And then the Vipassana technique says, can you, instead of naming it as pain, can you name its qualities? So that first quality is it's moving. And then you might see, and then they give these classical things around the elements. Oh, it's hot, it's heat, or it's heavy, or it's tingling, it's flowing. And you might, sometimes people have like colors in their mind, like they sort of see it, oh, it's kind of like purple or it's orange or something, which is just a, again, just like sort of making up, but it's just how things are, you're receiving things. So now you've, what the important thing that's happened here, one of the important things is that you've changed your relationship to this experience. Your fundamental relationship with discomfort ordinarily is aversion to it. It arises. I don't like it. I want to get away from it. I try to change it. Now, instead of that relationship, which is a conflicted relationship, and we could say dualistic, right? It's creating a duality of mind and body and problem and solving. It is interesting. That's a very different relationship from it sucks. I hate it. The relationship of, oh, this is interesting. What it, look at this. And boom, the mind like kind of goes, whoa, I've been spending my whole life trying to get away from pain, and it really isn't the thing that I thought it was. It's not a solid thing, and it's not as much of a problem as I thought it was. The problem was, guess what? In my mind, the bigger problem was the relationship to it, the conflicted relationship to it, which is, of course, what the Buddha teaches in the teaching on the two darts or the two arrows. The sensation, the initial sensation is one level of kind of pain, and then the mental reaction to it is a second pain, which kind of tends to double. Or you could even say there's almost like a, more than a doubling. It's like pain squared. It's more than doubling. Instead of just adding the two pains together, they're multiplying together. This is math. I'm really good at that. So, what I'm getting at it, where I think I'm going, might be, is, well, this practice with sensation that I learned a long time ago and I got pretty good at can also be applied to emotions. And that's what I was seeing in this feeling feelings number three. If you have one breath at a time, it's in step six, I think. I was seeing that, oh, if I'm just mindful of the what I think of as an emotion, in the same way as that I think of it as something as pain, it sort of stops being an emotion. The same way that pain stops being pain, it just becomes a kind of energy and flow of experience, just stuff happening that has a physical element, has a mental element. It's hard to even characterize it because it's not a solid thing. I saw that, but I really wasn't able to live out and sort of absorb the implications of that. Because it means that you can change your relationship to your emotional life in the same way you can change your relationship to the pain in the knees. And if you can change your relationship to your emotional life, you can change your life in a radical way. Instead of being trapped in a view of self and of diagnoses and of, conditions that you have, you can be curious, be interested. Because that relationship, as I said, with pain, that relationship to difficult emotions is one of conflict. There's an inherent conflict, and the terrible thing about this conflict is that it means I'm having feelings. I don't want those feelings, so I'm in conflict with myself. This inner conflict, which often includes, I shouldn't have that. What's wrong with me? Or even, I'm a bad person, or I'm a failure, or you know what? All the story that goes along with having feelings that you shouldn't have, that you don't want to have, and then getting diagnosed with all the thanks for that. And that when we step out of that paradigm of the, there is this thing that I have that has to be dealt with, that I have a rela that's a problem. When I step out of that into there are energetic experiences moving through my mind and body that at times are unpleasant, but I can be with them because I've developed the capacity to be with discomfort, which is, by the way, one of the things that people in recovery develop, either intentionally or just through the process. We have to learn to be with discomfort or we wouldn't be able to stay sober, right? That's kind of like one of the critical tools of recovery is like, I can have a bad day, but I keep going and I don't drink, right? So this is the same principle, like, oh, I can have a bad feeling, but I don't have to, go into a funk. I can just say, this is an unpleasant feeling right now. What am I going to do next? And that n what we do next then is the wholesome, wise, intuitive responses to things. Sometimes that is a response of acceptance. Sometimes it is a response of effort. Oh, it'd really be good for me to get up off the couch and get some exercise. Dan Siegel, I think this is in Jack Kornfield's Wise Heart book, psychiatrist. People come in with depression. He writes out on a prescription pad, writes something on a prescription pad, hands it to him. They look at it. Here's your prescription, 45 minutes of exercise a day. One of the antidotes to depression. It's not a cure. It's not a fix. But just as, and when we view these experiences, these feelings as states that can be dealt without being diagnosed, without believing there's something wrong with us, without feeling that we have to fix ourselves, but that we're having a relationship. And what am I going to do in this relationship? What's a wholesome way of responding? Now, very quickly, I need to step in here and intervene with myself, say, there are mental states. There are states of depression, anxiety, and worse that are not solved by mindfulness, by just seeing, oh, that's an unpleasant feeling. I'm not going to react to it. It's not all, everything isn't like that. So I'm not suggesting this is a, cure-all or a prescription. But I will say that for the ordinary types of moods that can become crippling, this can be a really powerful intervention and quite remarkable in its simplicity. It requires, I dare say, I think it requires, I mean, this is my opinion. I think it requires a pretty serious meditation practice, a pretty serious mindfulness practice. I don't think that I'm not sure it's possible that somebody who's untrained in mindfulness could just kind of get this kind of process and just do it, without any training. In any case, I will say that for those who are well trained in meditation, and that doesn't mean you're some expert or you have great, you're in the jhanas or anything, but just that you've done this practice a lot, you've experienced, been with, sat with your feelings and thoughts and emotions a lot, and sat with physical sensations, that having this understanding, can be enough to kind of pair that with your mindfulness training, and allow you to break some of those moods before they kind of, it's really a question of kind of intervening before they flower into full-blown, depressive states. It's more like, oh, that feels crappy. Okay, I guess I'll breathe. I'm not gonna, don't have to get into a story about it. It's just unpleasant, Think I'll, go make lunch and get on with my day. And this is one of the principles of recovery, which is suit up and show up, continue to keep going. Don't Don't let these challenges just stop us, cripple us. So I see that Wilson has, preemptively put up his hand. So I will stop here.
I'm sorry, I didn't know when we were supposed to put up our hand.
Oh no, go for it.
Okay.
So you're supposed to put it up, when you're inspired, and
That's
it's a message to me that maybe I've said enough.
not what it was meant to be. Your talking brought up a lot of things for me. I think I had shared a couple of weeks ago, that I'm right now about a month out of a treatment facility, a rehab facility for alcoholism. And I'm waking up, I'm out and I'm in a sober living house, and I am waking up feeling very, I guess the word you meant, very disturbed, in my mind, and multiple times a night. And I wake up in the morning, with the only way I can describe it is my brain on fire. And I move so fast out of bed to rush through brushing my teeth, to rush to one thing to the next. It's almost manic in a way. And severe anxiety, and that carries me through the morning, regardless of what I try to do. The only thing that does help is exercise. But what I think I'm recognizing is that this is the first time in my adult life that I haven't numbed this kind of feeling by using. Ever since 14, I have, I think, early recognized these kinds of feelings and started using and drinking. I'm in my wasn't morning using or drinking, but I would use enough in the afternoon and evenings and into the night to carry me through to coffee and nicotine and other things to get me until I had the next drink. And that has just, and this is the first time I think I've ever felt the severity of, and not this severity of mind without using. And it's painful. Like it feels like pain in the morning. And it comes with what you had mentioned around fear. And what I think I have done most of my life is given me myself a prescript, a diagnosis of my diagnosis of myself is the bad, I'm a bad person diagnosis, for lots of reasons. And that creates me having to prove and be manic and move fast and anxiety and fear. And I don't know. I'm sorry I'm going on so long, but so much of it ties together into living through what is feels like fire in the brain, pain, and in my chest, and I'm not self-medicating, and that's hard.
And that's fantastic. And frankly, that's the most important thing. That's the only way it's going to change. And this is why people relapse, because it's really hard. It can be really hard in the beginning. I know that this whole group is just shocked to hear your story, because no, it's so familiar, Wilson, and I really appreciate you sharing it, and that you're thinking, that you're looking at it, and you're dealing with it. It's really tough, and I am sorry you are having to go through it, because it's just really, what you're describing is very familiar and very painful. And I imagine that just about everybody on this Zoom call, if not everyone, really relates to what you're talking about, and many of us have gone through exactly what you're describing. And I think you know that. That's why you're sticking with it, because you've heard enough and you've learned enough to realize, oh, yeah, getting sober is really hard, and but you got to really stick with it. And of course, the thing that we're all going to tell you is that it does get better, and it absolutely will. Your life will change radically, and just your own. I hear your own wisdom and insight already, and that's going to be just. There's going to be more and more of that, and less of that agony. But there has to be this transition. Why else? If it weren't like this, then it wouldn't be an addiction, It's like, this is how it is. This is why addiction is so hard and so difficult. But I'm really glad you're showing up here, that you're choosing to show up here, because what I teach is not typically, I'm not typically thinking about you or the, and I mean the newcomer, the relative newcomer in my teaching. But there's no doubt that what I'm talking about, as you so clearly, responded, it is exactly the struggle of the pain of early recovery. Because just as you said, like that's what we spend our lives avoiding these difficult feelings. And when you remove that buffer, what do you think you're going to experience, But it's vital, absolutely vital, to understand impermanence in this, to understand, just as you're describing, that even as your days feel like a struggle, you're getting through things, and things. And there are different, you're experiencing different states even through the day. There are moments when you're not completely freaking out, right? There are moments when it's like, oh, okay, when I'm watching this TV show, I'm not really spinning out right now. But there are moments, like you say, like waking up and these different times when it's like, whoa, hold on. So that daily impermanence then is also will be, doubled, mirrored in the impermanence of these states, that 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months, and you're gonna see it unfolding, and it will not only get better, it will get easier, most importantly. Will not be this torture forever.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for showing up. Steve J.
Morning, Kevin. Thanks for that wonderful talk. Right smack in the middle of your talk, my phone lit up and I got a text message from my sister-in-law saying that let me know that my younger brother's back in the emergency room with another stroke.
Ugh.
And so I'm sitting here processing that. Well, going back and forth and getting off camera and listening to your talk and everything, and it correlates with what my experience is right now. Thanks to my mindfulness practice, my meditation practice, and doing this for such a long time now, I'm actually kind of surprised how I'm responding to this. This is not his first or second or third stroke, but he continues to not take care of himself. So I'm taking that state of mind from what you were talking about, and just allowing this process in my own head, my own mindfulness, to guide me through what I need to do. And I know what I need to do, and it's not pleasant, but it's something that I'm up for doing, and something I know I can handle. But I found it very interesting, just right when you were talking about this all of a sudden happens, So yeah, thank you for this. Somehow these talks, they just kind of fold around what's going on in my life in the current moment, but it's really helped me a lot. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I hope he's okay. Yeah, I mean, I hope that You know, what I'm talking about isn't theoretical, right? It's like it's applicable. I mean, I can stop right now and breathe and feel what I'm feeling and be aware of that. So, Eric, hi.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for
Hey.
being here on Tuesday mornings. It's meant a lot to me and my sobriety. And I found that I have very similar feelings to what Wilson was describing, and I have a few more 24 hours than he does, and not nearly as much as some other people in this room, but that yes, indeed, my life is getting better. I recognize the anxiety that I wake up with still after years of sobriety, and I call it my cement straitjacket because it's so suffocating,
Good.
and I so what resonates with me is that manic state to like I have this innate desire to fix things or to do something in order to do it, when in the reality, what I've found is if I can slow down and just be with it, then I'm okay. I've heard it said that if you're looking to the future and you're looking ahead, you're in anxiety, and if you're looking into the past, you're in regret, and that's just depression. And I have a sponsee right now, and I'm more of forward thinking. I don't worry as much about the past. I feel like I can I don't there's nothing I can do about it. For some reason, I think there's something I can do about the future, which I'm slowly learning I can't. But I have a sponsee who says, no, I just stay and worry about the past. And I'm like, well, I guess I'm glad I'm done with that part of it. My real point here is that just Wilson, the sharing of what you're experiencing resonates with every single person in this room. And we've all been through this, and it does get better. And for some reason, when I hear that other people are going through that too, it makes me feel better, because we're in this together, it's a we program. And I think through my process of meditation, I've felt a unity, specifically in the sanghas that I'm involved with. But really, I think the whole point is building the best relationship we possibly can with everyone in the world. What an order. But coming back. So thanks for letting me share about this. Wilson, thank you for sharing what you're going through because it's a good reminder for me.
Thanks,
Thanks, Aaron.
Eric. I love that cement straitjacket, and partly I love it because you're not giving yourself a diagnosis, you're just describing the feeling. And that I think is so key. It's very different. It's like, I'm not saying there's something wrong, it's just really unpleasant. And in Buddhist terms, I'm hearing that's the earth element, right? Like, okay, like, if you really want to just get really Buddhist about it, oh, I'm experiencing the earth element when I wake up. Like, instead of the story, which is like, what's wrong with me? What do I, I had a friend who was in my home group where I got sober in LA, and a decade later he showed up down in Balboa Island where I was in grad school, and Rick Chi G, and he Rick would share. He had a lot of energy. He was a biker and had this great long hair that was like bleached and stuff. It's just a really great and very handsome fellow. But he would say that his mind woke up 10 minutes before he woke up. And so that when he woke up, his mind w had already created all these problems for him. I see a lot of nods going on here. It's like, it's a great image, right? So it's interesting that, and I was talking about it, and Wilson was talking about it, Eric's talking about it, like that waking up in the morning, and like just really just interesting to see what a vulnerable time that is in our day, and just to be sensitive to ourselves and take care of ourselves at that moment. Gabrielle, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I know we're late,
Oh
so
yeah, we are. Yep. So sorry, you're done.
I wanted again to join with you and Eric in thanking Wilson, as I'm sure everyone does, for for being here and bringing it back home to me. I've been blessed with a lot of years of sobriety, but hearing his story, it takes me right back. You never forget the struggle and the moments, and when you're on your knees and you have no choice but to stop using or die, at least either emotionally or physically or both. You never forget that. And I kept, re I mean, I remember when the first times I was going to 12-step meetings and how it just, I never felt any relief. I didn't feel relief. I didn't feel relief. I kept waiting for the 12 cloud, the pink cloud. It didn't come. And I white knuckled myself for 3 years. And I'm sorry to say that, Wilson, but you know, that's what it's all about. You stay with it, you keep coming back, you know what to do now. And it's very simple. You show up, you call, you talk to people, you come to these meetings. And the thing that I have now after many years, which I didn't have then, was the Buddhist perspective, which has really, really helped my mind. And that's another thing, but this is a lifelong journey. And I hope we can all be here for you and that you'll be part of us too. And I thank you very much for this humble reminder and the whole group too. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Gabrielle. It's beautiful. I love hearing the group do what we do, which is, gather around the vulnerable, it's sort of the vulnerable one in the group, and it sort of makes me think about, the sort of those nature films where documentaries where you see like everybody gathering around like the sick elephant or something. Anyway, maybe not the best metaphor, but I'll just give a counter narrative too, that the first day of my sobriety, I woke up really happy. And I didn't stay happy every moment of my 40 years, but it wasn't torture for me right at that moment. I went through a lot of other stuff, but just to say there, I guess, speaking to Wilson again, just like it can take many different forms, and so don't worry. Just keep going. It's that simple principle, don't drink or use no matter what. Just suit up and show up, and one day at a time. And it's all we can do, and we all wish it could be, something we could turn on, turn off, fix, whatever, that life would just get solved. But it turns out that just showing up is more of a solution than anything else, I think. Anyway, on those brilliant, insightful words. I think we can finish up for the day. It was really great to see everybody, and see you next Tuesday.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Good to see you.
Thanks, everyone.
Everybody, take care.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yep.